From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A fight may be brewing between Greece and Germany over outstanding reparations from the Nazi occupation during World War II. Germany says it won't pay Greece World War II reparations after the Greek Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, said Berlin is using legal tricks to avoid paying the compensation. Germany says it's honored its obligations, while Greece says it may start seizing German property located in Greece. This was Yiannis Bournos, a member of the political secretariat of Syriza, Wednesday.
We are in a historically turbulent period for Europe, and I think that it's time that we reconsider all the necessary preconditions in order to restore the friendship and the unity which has been severely wounded in the period of the crisis among the peoples of Europe. So we believe that it's more of a moral obligation to close this chapter, this painful chapter of history in Europe. We are forced to do it now because actually the new Greek government is the only Greek government that has, let's say, under brackets, dared to put this painful historical matter into public dialogue. And since you're comparing this demand of the Greek parliament and the Greek government with our negotiations for what was used to be called the bailout of Greece, our European partners and the German government should take into consideration that Greece is committed to serve its obligations. So it's now time for also the other sides to act in the same manner. Until today, there have been quite a few researches operated by several committees, but I can't give you an exact number right now. This will be the task of the new parliamentary committee that was approved yesterday. Since we are committed to serve our obligations, so the other side should also act in the same manner. So we are optimistic that in the end, we will find a solution through dialogue, a mutually accepted solution. I insist that this is something more than that. It's not a trick. It's not a trick to twist Germany's arm. I believe that it's a rightful demand of the Greek people that has never before been expressed by the previous governments. The Greek Minister of Justice announced in the parliament that he is willing to sign the decision of the Greek higher court, according to which 2,000 relatives of the victims of the massacre in the town of Dystomo by the Nazi army during the Nazi occupation are now entitled to German reparations for this massacre, and these reparations can be fulfilled through the confiscation of German state assets located in Greece.
While Germany refuses to even discuss war reparations, Greece's Justice Minister, Nikos Paraskevopoulos, said Wednesday that Athens could start seizing German assets right away. Paraskevopoulos said he was, quote, ready to approve, closed quote, a Greek Supreme Court ruling in 2000 that would allow the appropriation of assets belonging to Germany's archaeological school and other properties, with the proceeds to be used as compensation for the relatives of 218 civilians who were massacred by Nazi troops in a village in central Greece in June of 1944. The Greek Justice Minister told Antenna TV, quote, the law states that the minister must give the order for the Supreme Court ruling to be carried out. I am ready to give that order, closed quote. China's Foreign Minister Hong Li Wednesday expressed his country's hope that Venezuela and the United States will handle relations between the two on the basis of equality, respect, and non-interference in the internal affairs of other nations, principles of international law that, he said, are applicable to all relations between states. In his regular Beijing press conference, he urged the two states to treat their bilateral relations appropriately at this time of growing tension between them. The outcry against Washington's moves against Venezuela is also spreading across Latin America and the Caribbean, as the nations of that region are taking steps to help Caracas weather the impacts of any U.S. sanctions. Press TV's Taya Bay Cotaverde filed this report.
Relations between Washington and Caracas have hit a new low after the United States declared Venezuela a national security threat and slapped sanctions against several Venezuelan officials. Washington accuses Caracas of cracking down on political opponents. The Venezuelan president reacted by accusing the Obama administration of trying to topple his government.
Today, President Barack Obama's measure is the most aggressive, unfair, and harmful step the U.S. has ever taken against Venezuela, the land of Bolivar. You have no right to mess with the people of Venezuela and this country of peace. President Obama was wrong in his decision.
The U.S. move seems to be in response to a decision by Caracas to reduce the number of U.S. embassy staff from 100 to 17. Caracas says American diplomats have engaged in covert political activities.
The policy of the U.S. is to use the U.S. embassy as a base inside the country, but they also have been providing tens of millions of dollars in funding to opposition groups. U.S. embassy officials have been exposed as having written the script of the actual video that was going to be aired if the coup plot had succeeded on February 12th of this year.
Meanwhile, the member states of the Union of South American Nations have come to Maduro's defense by rejecting any foreign meddling in the country.
The states of UNASUR, without exception, reject and will continue rejecting any attempt to destabilize democracy in Venezuela, be it from external or internal sources.
The UNASUR has also agreed to give basic products to Venezuela as the country is facing shortage of such items. The Venezuelan government accuses the opposition of hoarding food items in order to stir public unrest. Talks of a coup and unrest are a reminder of the events of April 2002, when late President Hugo Chavez was briefly ousted from power. At the time, the United States threw its support behind those who had claimed power. However, the coup was over within 2 days after people protested en masse to support Chavez. Now, the new round of U.S. punitive measures against Venezuela comes as Washington is normalizing ties with longtime foe Cuba. Havana, which resisted 5 decades of harsh U.S. economic sanctions, has offered unconditional support to Caracas. The U.S. says its sanctions and pressures against the government of President Maduro are in response to the deteriorating human rights situation there. But many of the major recipients of the U.S. assistance in Latin America have been notorious for their bleak human rights record.
Ecuador's President Rafael Correa announced that the U.S. threat to Venezuela will be the topic of a meeting of the Union of South American Nations, UNASUR, on Thursday. Telesur's Liz Scherfius reports from Quito.
In light of recent U.S. sanctions placed on Venezuelan officials and the executive order declaring the country a threat to national security, President of Ecuador Rafael Correa has confirmed that the foreign ministers of the UNASUR body will be meeting in Montevideo this Thursday to prepare for a summit of the heads of state next week.
Thursday, in Montevideo, the foreign ministers of UNASUR will meet to prepare a summit of heads of state next week to provide an appropriate response to this grotesque, illegal, shameful, unprecedented, and unwarranted interference by the United States in Venezuela's internal affairs.
This announcement by Correa follows the U.S. executive order issued on Monday, which described the situation in Venezuela as an extraordinary and unusual threat to U.S. national security and foreign policy. Correa said that the UNASUR heads of state will meet to discuss the situation in Venezuela and reject what he called illegal and shameless U.S. interference in the region. Liz Scherfius, Telesur, Ecuador.
Meanwhile, the Venezuelan National Assembly gave preliminary approval of a bill granting President Nicolas Maduro special executive powers to act against the threats from Washington, which he said are aimed at destabilizing the country and overthrowing the elected socialist government. Maduro said that, despite the U.S. threats, this year's elections would proceed as planned. He addressed the assembly prior to the vote on the special bill.
Pido a Dios protección.
I ask God for protection. If major events shake our country, whether I'm alive or not, the order is rain or shine. Parliamentary elections will happen this year, whether the empire wants it or not. We are going to parliamentary elections and let the people decide what will happen in this country. And we will go into it with the same position as always. If we win, win. If we lose, lose. That's it. Democracy, peace, and constitution is what we want.
The Venezuelan constitution requires approval by 60% of the legislators in such actions, It received 99% of the votes at Tuesday's reading from the Great Patriotic Poll Alliance, the largest voting bloc in the Assembly, with 99 of 164 seats. The bill will move to a vote for final approval Sunday, where it's expected to pass easily. The ceasefire in Ukraine may be holding, but more fighting may be ahead, as Reuters reports that an unnamed U.S. government official said Wednesday that Washington will increase military aid to the Ukrainian government with as many as 30 armored Humvee vehicles and drones to be sent to Kiev within weeks. Meanwhile, a retired U.S. general said that American intervention in Ukraine should involve the spilling of Russian blood. Robert Scales, a retired U.S. major general and a Fox News military analyst, called U.S. involvement in Ukraine a game, set, and match situation, adding that, quote, the only way the U.S. can have any effect in the region is to start killing Russians, closed quote. Next week will mark the fourth anniversary of the commencement of a U.S.-led war against the North African nation of Libya, which included a massive bombing campaign against that country of 6 million people that continued every day from March 19th until mid-November 2011. The war left thousands dead and resulted in the brutal murder of that country's leader, Muammar Gaddafi, on October 20th of 2011. CPR's Bernard White spoke with Abiyomi Ezekwe, publisher of the Pan-African Newswire, a daily international news service on Pan-African and global affairs, about the state of affairs on the ground in Libya and how the country that was once the jewel of Africa was bombed into chaos and despair by the U.S. and its NATO allies.
And one of the one of the stories that has fallen out of the news, every now and then it seeps back in, but only when they're talking about Hillary Clinton, is Libya. And things have really, really changed over since the assassination of Gaddafi. Can you give us an update on what's happening in Libya?
It's very important because we're coming up on the fourth anniversary of the Pentagon and NATO massive aerial bombardment of Libya in 2011. That started on March the 19th. And it was a direct result of the United Nations Security Council and the role of the United States and its allies like France and Britain, who strong-armed other countries on the Security Council to go along with this so-called no-fly zone. And those of us who have been studying these developments in U.S. foreign policy for many years, no-fly zone is just a code word for bombing whenever they get ready. And we saw that in Iraq leading up to the Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003. Between 1991 and 2003, the United States bombed Iraq very frequently, sometimes heavily. You know, we can remember back in 1998, Bill Clinton, during the Christmas and New Year season, engaged in massive aerial bombardments against Iraq. This was short of a full-scale war, and then the sanctions killed hundreds of thousands more, even children. So when they said that they were going to impose a no-fly zone over Libya, that means they were going to declare absolute war, and that's what they did. Then they took these dissident groups, some of whom had been in prison and were released by the Gaddafi government. They armed these people. They already had ties with the Central Intelligence Agency for decades and set them loose, first in Benghazi in the east of the country and other parts of the east. And then when the Gaddafi government, which had largely been demilitarized as a result of negotiations with the Bush administration, when they mobilized largely volunteer forces to battle these counter-revolutionaries. This was in February of 2011 and early March. The U.S. and the imperialist countries went to the United Nations Security Council to get two resolutions. One was to impose an arms embargo on the Libyan government under Gaddafi. and also to set up a naval blockade, which they did. And then the second was to authorize a so-called no-fly zone. So these two resolutions, 1970 and 1973, were really declarations of war. And they used the United Nations Security Council to get legitimacy to what they wanted to do. But all the people that voted in favor of these resolutions and who participated in the war are culpable in regard to the chaos and destabilization and underdevelopment that's going on right now in Libya. You have numerous rebel groups, which are an outgrowth of this imperialist war of regime change in 2011, who are constituting themselves as a law unto themselves. Now you have the intervention of the Islamic State, and this has given a raison d'etre to Egypt to come in and to also engage in aerial bombardments, as well as the United Arab Emirates. Then you have two regimes that are vying for international recognition. The one that supposedly is recognized by the United States and the United Nations is not even in the capital of Tripoli. They were driven out of the capital by another group who occupy the capital now, which are supported, it is said, by Qatar. And the other group, which claims to be the legitimate government in Libya now, is holed up in a hotel in the eastern region of the country in the city of Tobruk. So this is the state of affairs right now in Libya, 4 years after the war, the brutal assassination of Muammar Gaddafi, and the installation of a government in Libya composed of people largely who hadn't even lived in the country for decades, who were living abroad and who were subsidized by the U.S. government, the CIA, and they were sent back there to rule the country when they had absolutely no idea what the institutions that had been established and the gains that had been made in Libya during the 42-year rule of Gaddafi. Now, Gaddafi took over in a military coup in 1969, and that country in 1969 was one of the poorest in Africa. And within a matter of a decade, they had made substantial economic gains. And by the 1980s, they had become one of the probably the most prosperous country in Africa. And at the time of the war, they were the most prosperous country in Africa. They had the largest known oil reserves in Africa, and they were investing in infrastructural projects in other African states. Gaddafi had even been chairman of the African Union during 2009 and 2010. So you're talking about a former chair of the Continental Organization being attacked, you know, by the United States, France, Britain, Italy was involved, Canada was the titular head of the NATO operation that ostensibly took over from the United States in regard to the leadership. But all of this was done in the effort to seize Libyan oil and also to take the billions upon billions of dollars of Libyan wealth. I mean, they had over $170 billion just in foreign reserves. They had virtually no debt to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And the country had invested heavily in infrastructure. They had a great man-made river project that was designed to provide hydroelectric power and resources to a heavily arid country. You had at least 2 million guest workers in Libya. Now, when they say that, you know, Libya was not doing well economically, then if you're not doing well economically, why would you have a country that size with a population of approximately 5 to 6 million people at most, with a vast amount of land, with tremendous natural resources and tremendous national assets, have 2 million workers from outside the country who come there seeking employment? They had construction firms. They had people working in the healthcare industry. They had people working in services. These are total myths that were fostered by the corporate media to make it appear as if Libya was facing some type of imminent collapse or crisis, and that the Gaddafi government, the Jemahiriya, was going to engage in mass killings inside the country. None of this was substantiated. And what's even worse today is that these same people who engineered and rationalized and apologized for this imperialist destruction of Libya today speak so objectively, like they had nothing to do with creating the conditions that exist in Libya today. You see it from the British, from the United States, from the French, from the Italians. They all talk about what, you know, pondering over what they can do to help the situation in Libya, when in fact they created the crisis in Libya. And Libya today is not only a threat to its own people in terms of those who are governing the country, it's also spreading instability throughout North and West Africa as well. It is credited. The fallout from the war of regime change in 2011 is credited with the current war that is going on right now in northern Mali, which started several months after the overthrow of the Gaddafi government in Libya. All of these developments fall at the feet of Washington, of Wall Street, of London, of Brussels, of Paris. You know, these are the capitals where these decisions are being made over what country is going to be attacked next, what people are going to be starved to death, what sanctions are going to be imposed on which country. So people in the United States really need to take these factors into consideration when they look at U.S. foreign policy.
One of the things I was wondering about is that when Gaddafi was overthrown, what surfaced in Libya was this treatment of black Libyans who were being lynched and who were being chased out of the country. Has that abated?
Well, a lot of people have been dislocated, you know, whole villages in certain regions of the country. People were forced to flee because under his government, he had empowered the indigenous Libyans who are black, you know. And that's another thing that the opportunists and the reactionaries and the imperialists didn't like. He had said years ago that he was leaving the Arab League, you know, but he said it was a funny organization and he wasn't clear what his purpose was, and that he was going to work exclusively with Africa. And that's basically how he conducted his foreign policy from the late 1980s to the time of his death. So they always try to make this artificial division between what they call Africa north of the Sahara and Africa south of the Sahara. And it's really a false construct because a lot of the indigenous people there, even those who appear to be Arab, a lot of those people were Arabized after the 7th century. And a lot of them have lived there for thousands of years. If you read even people like Dr. Chancellor Williams, he talks about this, and others, other historians who talk about this. And because you have the Berber peoples, you have the Tuareg people, some of the Bedouin groups. Traditionally, you have the Chaldeans and the Yazidis. There are so many other groups, the Assyrians, that have their own languages, and they don't, they have identified as being Arab for political reasons, and some of them still object to that categorization. So these are some of the complexities, you know, about the political realities in North Africa that you don't hear a lot about. But the fact of the matter is that they attempt to isolate Islam, isolate the Arabs, isolate the other groups in North Africa and the Middle East, and also to make Africa appear as if it's a hopeless case that justifies and warrants U.S. military intervention. And this is what's going on right now. And the U.S. military intervention is not stabilizing the situations in these countries. It's making it worse. If we look at Mali, we look at Libya, look at Sudan, you know, all of these countries have had the intervention of the United States in one way or the other. And it has not helped them to unify and to stabilize their societies. In fact, it has been extremely divisive, the whole process.
Okay. One other thing about Libya, I'm just wondering, with the absence of Gaddafi, how has that impacted on the goals of the African Union?
Well, right now, President Mugabe of Zimbabwe is the chair of the African Union and the Southern African Development Community, the regional organization in the subcontinent. So there has been more emphasis on the need for land reform, for the people, the indigenous people of Africa benefiting from the mineral wealth of the country. But the question is, how do we apply this? And that's going to be the real issue, because the economic growth that we saw in Africa over the last several years did not bring about the type of infrastructural improvements that were necessary. There have been infrastructural improvements. The use of mobile phones, for example, has revolutionized trade, communication. So this has helped, you know, foster food production and other economic growth. But it's still vulnerable from the standpoint that a lot of the countries are still dependent on foreign exchange earnings from mineral and agricultural resource exports. So when you have a decline in commodity prices, for example, like we have now, oil has gone down, other commodities, the prices have gone down. So a lot of these countries are experiencing economic shocks. So, yeah, this is happening in Africa and Libya as well. Now, you have an oil glut now, but at the same time, oil production in Libya has been cut almost down to nil because of all the fighting that's going on inside the country. It was reported just yesterday that the ISIS affiliates in Libya had kidnapped some oil workers and taken over some oil installations in the country. The two rival regimes there have both been fighting over control of the oil installations as well as the oil revenues that are still coming in. So all of this does not bode well for economic development and growth. And, you know, people still, you read the corporate media, and a lot of times they still refer to Muammar Gaddafi as a dictator. You know, Muammar Gaddafi was not perfect. He made his mistakes. He made his errors, just like any other human being. But if you compare the situation in Libya under his government, under the Jamahiriya system of people's committees and local government and self-controlled municipal entities, compared to what exists now, I believe a lot of people in Libya now wish that they could have maintained the system that had existed for so many years inside the country. Because what you have now is total chaos. And people are going to be leaving the country, even in larger numbers. And the country is not going to benefit from its wealth. And then the imperialists are trying to debate on whether to go back into the country on the ground. So this is a strategic campaign on the part of the United States, France, Britain, Canada, Italy, Norway, in collaboration with Turkey and these neocolonial Arab and African states who went along with this travesty of justice. It is they who should be held accountable for what's going on in Libya now.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.